You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Bill Arnig. Bill, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to come talk about the museum.
So Bill, yeah, let's talk about the museum, and I guess to begin with, let's talk about what is the current show coming up. And of course, we're talking about the Contemporary Arts Museum, Houston. What's the current show on? Just to plug that, because this will be coming out in the next week when listeners could potentially come.
Okay. Well, right now we have a survey of Angel Otero, who is still quite a young artist. He's in his 30s now, but he started showing when he was in his early 20s. Originally in Chicago, our senior curator, Valerie Cassell Oliver, was in Chicago for a number of years of her career and is deeply tied to the students that came out of the school, the Art Institute there. So she's known Angel since he was, like, getting his first attention when he was still, like, 22 and 23. And we had she had done a large survey of abstraction by black artists, black in the abstract, about 3 years ago. And she had included one of his really majestic skin paintings. And she said, you know, he's a young artist, but he really hasn't had the museum attention anywhere, and I'd love to do it. And it is a very marvelous show. His earliest works, when he was starting to peel skins off paint cans and use them to form images of his grandmother's patio furniture back in Puerto Rico, up through his most recent paintings that are these sort of grand Picasso-esque figurative paintings, his story is really just emotional, because he talked about he was a young artist coming from Puerto Rico. His knowledge of art was sort of up through Picasso and Matisse and maybe Jackson Pollock. And he arrives at the School of the Art Institute, and he is just unprepared to be around all of these young people who are really into the art of the moment and determined to take his place. So he was like trying to figure out who he was as a young Puerto Rican painter. It's just it's a marvelous show, and even though he's known as a kind of expressionist painter, it's a really charming show. There's a lightness to it and a charm, particularly these strange crumbled metallic ceramic sculptures that percolate through the whole show.
It's exciting. That it sounds really exciting, and in keeping with the museum, sounds like it's so much a part of the museum's mission. So let's talk about that a little bit. How the museum developed its mission, and I know its history beginning in the 50s as being cutting edge, bringing in shows,
yeah,
and having a lot of controversial and exciting shows throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But since you've come on, the museum's also continued to get a lot of acclaim, getting award-winning shows. So I guess my question is, how do you approach these shows and keep the museum on what's been recognized as having great international, great national shows, great cutting-edge shows? What makes a great cutting-edge show, and how does that happen?
Well, it is important to think about the context of Houston, because for a city which is currently either the third or the fourth biggest city in America, we're kind of neck and neck with Chicago now for size. We have a number of really great institutions. And when we look at our mission, it's that our audience has and will often go on the same day to the Blaffer, which is the University of Houston's museum, the Manil, which is one of the best museums on the planet, and the Museum of Fine Arts, which is a great sort of story of mankind museum, which is directly across the street. So we are we have a freedom, because the city is so well populated with museums, that it's not our job to sort of tell the standard history of post-war art. We get free to do these things that are edgier and riskier. And an artist like Angel Otero, whose position in art history is not assured yet, he's still very young. So when we do shows like that, we're allowed to do that because we have such other great institutions in the city. One of the shows a lot of your listeners have probably seen, because it toured to both Los Angeles and is now in New York, is the Marilyn Minter Retrospective. And Marilyn, I've worked with her so much over the years, and it was great to collaborate with the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver and Alyssa Arthur, who's now at the Museum of Art and Design in New York, who's a great feminist curator, to put this show on the road. And it was it's a risky show. I mean, when Marilyn Minter started as a feminist painter doing hardcore porn images in the 80s, that is still shocking for a big part of the audience. And we were able to do it because we have a very educated audience here that sees an awful lot of the best work from the world. We have coming here, it was just an awareness of having a freedom because of the context of the city. We also just did a very big survey for Mark Flood, who is probably one of the most worldwide celebrated artists who's from here, who continued to live here. There's other ones like Dario Robledo and Trenton Doyle Hancock that have had significant retrospectives who continue to be here. But Flood is kind of one of the great bad boy artists of our time. And a lot of museums were kind of scared to go near the work. He can be a provocateur. His full-length feature film, Art Fair Fever, is one of the funniest send-ups of the art world. So doing that show was kind of a no-brainer for us, since he's here and he is someone we could celebrate and give significant critical attention to.
So that's exciting that you were able to give him attention and other artists who may be difficult to handle. And I like that you put it in the context of Houston, which has such great support for the arts. I mean, talking about outsiders, artists, you know, from different countries. You also, unlike the Whitney, it seems, you know, which has in a way would seem a similar program, but it's national, and your scope is international. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have a show coming up in a few weeks with Lily Vanderstoker, and it's she's going to be having a solo project as part of a larger thematic show of artists doing biographical narrative, in along with Jack Early and Drew Young Trey. And so we get to do international shows, and then we also get to do the very local shows. One thing we noticed was our audience loves when we do design shows, things that are outside of a traditional fine arts situation. And like, we did a show, it's about 2 years ago now, called Texas Design Now, because something about the scale of the state allows people who are doing large-scale furniture and interiors, as well as fashion designers, to stay based here. And that show it hit so many notes. People love seeing the type of furniture design and fashion design that was coming out of Texas.
Well, that's very interesting. On that note, and forgive me if this is moving into politics a little bit, but how does the museum manage, you know, what ultimately becomes kind of message oriented about shows that are dealing with politics, with racism, with outsiders?
Houston is a very diverse city. We were one of the first, what you hear the phrase, minority-majority cities in America. Valerie Castle Oliver, who's one of the leading figures among African-American curators working in the country today, has done a lot of work and is sort of one of the legendary figures in curating black artists. In fact, her show Radical Presence, which was a history of black performance art, toured to Yerba Buena Art Center in San Francisco, the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and is now seen as a sort of really history-defining show. Also, we are it's a very progressive city in terms of intellectual thought. I had been the curator at the MIT List Visual Arts Center for the 10 years before coming here, and I hadn't been to Houston. I had even juried a show of Houston artists for the Blaffer in 2003. So I knew the city had a good scene, but I did not know quite how broad and diverse and progressive it was. And then I get here, and within 6 months of my moving here, they elect Anise Parker, who was one of the great mayors in America, but also an out lesbian and very much a part of the scene here. And she and her wife were the sort of first couple of the city for 6 years until she term limited out and couldn't be reelected again. So it's a very interesting place to be. Watching the current political situation from here is totally fascinating because we have probably equal Republicans and Democrats among our main donors, but even the way they're negotiating the new landscape is not necessarily along the traditional party lines. And for me, that's much more interesting than the landscape I saw when I lived in Cambridge, where pretty much everyone had nearly identical worldviews.
Well, that's really exciting to hear that, you know, people aren't thinking of this along party lines, and that's, you know, there's some things that are obviously changing with this new political landscape, we'll call it, you know, the surges in kinds of support in different areas, like the ACLU is getting apparently record amounts of support because we realize so much is under fire. It sounds like the community and the supporters and the donors that the museum has are similar. Do you find that in this, I mean, I'm kind of asking what you project is happening in the next few years in terms of arts and the support and for your museum. Do you see it as growing under this kind of situation? Is it more challenging, or can we expect, like the ACLU, there to naturally be more support because we realize it's all under fire?
You know, I don't see it's having a huge effect in terms of our donor base. We are what affects our donor base is how the oil industry is doing. Ultimately, all the money in Houston goes back to oil and gas, and that is being affected by a lot of external forces, including the amount of oil coming out of the Middle East. So I've never thought when I trained to be an art historian that I'd have to be as aware of the price per barrel as I am, but you have to have it in your daily news feed here. Because if I'm going out to do a big donor call and oil prices have dropped in the last 24 hours, I'm going to get a no. If they've gone up, I'm more likely to get a yes.
That's great. That's very interesting.
It's what's quite different. My last gig was a university gallery where the support for the arts was based a lot on the way the administration was seeing arts in student life. So it was a different kind of deal there.
Right. And to talk about your position now here as director, how does that influence the kind of exhibits and exhibitions that are coming up? Of course, you have curators, senior curators who are managing these exhibits, but the director, of course, has an influence of all of that. And how do you see yourself influencing that? What is it that you nurture or encourage there in terms of what curators look for and present?
Well, I do tell them that I think it's the job of our museum to be the wild one in the city and not to worry about censorship from the top, which I think a lot of curators have to worry about in institutions about, like, oh, maybe you've gone too far. When one of my biggest donors says it's your job to keep the CAM wild, I take that seriously. And it's because we have the traditional history of 20th century art so well told directly across the street. And they're about to open a new Stephen Hall building, which will have the history up until now in a very direct kind of way in a gorgeous new facility that's going to be opening in 2018, so, you know, relatively right around the corner. So we get to be the scrappier one. We get to be wilder. You probably know Jamal Cyrus, who's a pretty well-known artist today. He was on the front of the museum with a giant deep fryer set up where he breaded a saxophone and amplified the sound of a breaded saxophone being put into a deep fryer. This is something which I don't see a lot of museums able to do. I saw the piece done also at the Contemporary in Austin and at Yerba Buena Art Center in San Francisco. So there's a type of museum in the country, which has in its DNA some alternative space qualities. And since I came out of running White Columns in the 80s, that alternative space ethos is deeply embedded in my genes.
Right. White Columns then was nurturing a lot of quite extraordinary artists in the 80s. I mean, maybe to speak a little bit about that, at that time at White Columns, there was an awful lot of people came through there, right? From
We did
John
shows
Curran
for Katie Nolan, Felix Gonzalez Torres, John Curran, Andre Serrano. So these are that was sort of my generation of people I worked with, and I still get to we just had Jim Hodges here to give a lecture. We have a new lecture series, the Gamson Lecture Series, and this was the kickoff. And Jim and I did our first show together in 1992, so that's a little ways back. And we were just having dinner and going, it's so amazing that here, decades later, we're still able to be on a similar trajectory.
So to talk about, since you've seen artists from, you know, in over the course of decades, maybe to speak a little bit about, if we can, what is it that keeps some artists vital or within your radar vision? And I mean, kind of the question I'm getting at is also, you know, how are artists found or noticed by the museum?
Okay.
Just as
well,
how are they found or noticed by White Columns?
One of the things is because I, as a director now, I don't get to do many curatorial projects. So when I pick one, it's usually someone I know I have a good working relationship with. So my next one is coming up in 2019, and it's a Mary Weatherford retrospective that I'm going to co-organize, co-curate with Ian Berry at the Tang Museum at Skidmore College. And this is, I want to work with her because, like Marilyn Minter, the public, when you say Mary Weatherford, they have an image of the neon paintings that got so omnipresently successful 10 years ago. And I'm like, no, there's 20 years of interesting work before that that the public knows about only slightly. So I always want to do a show like this, working with another curator who's got a different perspective, the way I worked with Alyssa Arthur on Minter. But that goes back. This is someone I showed when I was at White Columns years ago, and we have, three decades of discussion about her work and each move, and that's what I like to bring to it. One of my favorite things to do is there's artists that, we had Mary Hellman's retrospective here before I was here, but I knew Mary well. I had worked with her in the olden days, and I saw her in New York maybe just about a year and a half ago, and she said, Bill, you haven't been to my studio in 15 years. Why don't you come over tomorrow? And I went over, and I'm looking at the group of paintings that are in the front room, and there was one from the 70s, one from the early 80s when I first met her, and then one from last year. And I'm like, Mary, it's so interesting to see three decades of work here and be able to realize this is all the same sensibility and the same type of artist. And she goes, honey, when you get to be my age, not believing in chronological time is a good thing. And I was like, and I thought, well, that's something I can, a type of wisdom I should say to myself every day. Like, there's one of the things about artworks is they're time travelers. They connect the past to the present in object form, and I get the joy of visiting artists over decades for this.
It's fascinating, and that's a wonderful, wonderful phrase. I mean, but that also, it's something different than, of course, what young artists think, which is they're developing bodies of work. They see one body of work grow out of another, and there's a kind of consistent narrative to it. So what she's saying is really wonderful. In to talk about the role of nonprofits like White Columns, I mean, of course, the museum's a nonprofit as well. But do you think it's still spaces like White Columns that are beginning to launch artist careers and other nonprofits as opposed to museums? Because the museum is really dealing with artists who are a level up from nonprofits like White Columns. Is that correct or no?
One of the things I love wherever I go is every city has these smaller, really interesting apartment galleries, ones where you're going into someone's home. Houston has a new one called John Hobson Gallery that is in this beautiful 1920s craftsman house. And then I go to Los Angeles and I go out to Koreatown and I see galleries like Parkview. And then I go to Denver and see David Smith Gallery. And then whenever I go, I love checking those types of galleries out. And I'm convinced that, and you know, they're commercial galleries, but they're done for this other reason. They're done because young people see the scene needs something. It needs types of venues. And so wherever I go, I'll generally check into the local alternative space. I'll find out what they're doing, but then I'll also look for the smaller galleries. And they all seem to talk to one another, and they all seem to be in communication because they know it's a financially very precarious thing to do. I do what I can to support. I'm about to... Today I'm having lunch with a young gallerist who's opened a new space in his apartment here called Blank Check, and he managed to get a pretty well-known painter, Michael Bevilacqua, to be his opening show a few months ago, a sort of high-profile debut. I guess he had had a few shows before. And I'm like, it's the least we can do in our communities is to try to support these visionary young people, like just putting on shows in their living room because that needs to happen.
And that really is, that's interesting. I'm so glad you mentioned that because that's really a kind of a new form, a hybrid almost between, like you say, they're commercial galleries, but they're functioning almost as nonprofits. Those are also places that artists can launch their careers at times, but at the same time, they're bringing in sometimes major figures, as the Suburban was, and as it sounds like the gallerists that you're meeting this afternoon are. So is it that a new form? Do you see that as a new form, these kind of apartment galleries that are popping up everywhere that are commercial spaces, yet somehow exciting and seem sort of fresh because they're not the typical white box?
Well, I love that you brought up the Suburban because that's always one of my favorite places. And it's and Michelle Grabner, who does everything. She's an educator and a painter and a critic and a curator and runs a space. Whenever I get to see Michelle in person and I look at the type of energy he has, that's what the art world relies on. We rely on people who are just as passionate as Michelle and are willing to do these things. I remember staying in the guest bedroom at the Suburban during one Chicago trip and just seeing like these art world luminaries that would just drop by because when you're in Chicago, you're going to go see Michelle Grabner. We just had a beautiful show, which was a two-artist show of Kay Rosen and Matt Keegan. And two artists of very different biographies, and they have this long relationship. And I love that, you know, Kay Rosen has managed to be one of the best-known language-based conceptualists, basing her whole career in Gary, Indiana. Those things I just find so inspiring.
That is exciting. So it's great talking to you. Before we go, there's always a question I ask, which is about what you're reading. I've been asking different people what they're currently reading, and if you wouldn't mind me asking that, or if you'd share that with us, it could be off topic or anything. What are you reading now?
I just came back from giving a lecture and meeting artists in Israel. So I had a very long flight last Sunday, and I'm still a little jet lagged from it. And I read Felix Picano, who is a great memoirist, and he wrote this book called Nights at Rizzoli about when he worked at the Rizzoli bookstore in New York in the early 70s. And it's a very entertaining read. It's got these great anecdotes about Jackie Kennedy coming to him and he's waiting on her without recognizing her, any stories like that. And I wasn't thinking about this as something I was needing for work. And then I was finishing up a catalog essay for the show called A Better Yesterday, the one with Lily Vanderstoker and Jack Early and Ju Young Che. And I realized that the idea of what a memoir is in terms of visual art was important for this. And I ended up going back into the book after finishing reading it and finding this great quote about the nature of how memoirs are a form of time travel. And then I realized art objects could be a form of time travel too. So that's the last book I read. And it is immediately relating into my work.
Bill, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure to hear about your work and, of course, the museum.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.